This week, gold and silver held up well amid increased market volatility. Well, welcome everyone. Chris Waltzek, so good to be back with you again on this Muy Grande size show with two of the world's leading financial wizards, Dr. Burton Malkiel, Professor Emeritus at Princeton University, returns to the show to discuss the 11th edition of his magnum opus, A Random Walk Down Wall Street. His outlook for 2016 is less than sanguine. Equities in most asset classes are overvalued, he thinks, but that's the perfect opportunity to increase diversification in one's portfolio. He notes even the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett himself, has publicly denounced active investing, you know, that thing that made him like $50 billion, instructing his heirs to engage in passive investing, i.e. buy index ETFs. The professor shares his favorite ETF with virtually no expense ratio at all, and he likes adding some bonds in here as well. Next up, Dr. Mark Faber, a favorite of the show for over a decade, economist and editor of the Gloom Boom Doom Report, expects the Fed to backpedal with the new rate hikes. I'm somewhat inclined to agree with him. There's looks like 90% odds that the Fed will hold rates steady at this month's meeting. Policymakers are pushing on a string, he says. Monetary expansion is far less effective with each installment. He also notes that the majority of shares are already in a bear market, and we're seeing that in Europe as well as in China this week. And he recently added to his gold position, using market weakness as an opportunity to pick up even more ounces. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Partly sunny skies appeared over the New York COMEX exchange this week as investors worldwide turned away from cratering equities markets in favor of the precious metals safe haven. Gold slipped just $15, finishing at just shy of $1,100. Silver, though, ended near the break-even point, just shy of $14 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index dropped 5.6 points, about 12% at 41. West Texas Intermediate Crude dropped $2.50, about 7%, ending at $30 a barrel. The top story driving the precious metals this week was dollar strength. The U.S. dollar continues to climb on anticipation of higher rates at the next FOMC meeting. However, the Fed funds futures odds are virtually nil for a rate hike this month, so I expect rates to hold pat at 0.5%. Fed officials have made it clear that rate hikes will be gradual, and that's likely in no small part due to retail sales and the manufacturing numbers released this Friday, which indicated more sluggish than expected U.S. economic conditions. The American consumer is clearly holding tightly to their wallets and pocketbooks, diminishing growth prospects. Plus, West Texas Intermediate crude plunged to a 12-year low, briefly below $30 a barrel, which sent reverberations worldwide, particularly in the energy shares, dropped over 6%. U.S. production slumped by 500,000 barrels a day. One report suggested that the slowdown in China has added to downward momentum in the energy sector. Precious metals bottom line. As mentioned in the last report, weakness in shares undermine the metals, while dollar strength and strength in the 30-year T-bond are also safe haven investments. Precious metals bottom line. T-bonds, the dollar, and even the precious metals are essentially the safe haven assets currently. But until that XAU index starts to turn around, caution is advisable. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds reappeared over the New York Stock Exchange on heels of a fresh 12-year low in the crude oil market, sent the energy shares plunging yet again to new lows. The Dow finished at 15,988, off about 362% for the week, nothing like last week, thank goodness, while the S&P 500 ended off about 41 at 1880, 2% loss. The NASDAQ fell 155 points, 3% down to 4488. Disappointing economic readings, including manufacturing data from the Empire State Factory Index early Friday, indicated the least rosy conditions since the last recession, while the Producer Price Index also fell, adding to deflation concerns. Intel Corp. dropped 9% on weak profit guidance. Officials noted the weakest expected sales since 2008. In addition, the Shanghai ETF, ticker PEK, plunged for the third week, wiping out most of last year's spectacular gains, while European shares fell into bear market territory officially, bottom line on Wall Street. Well, very little really has changed, I think, technically speaking, since last week. Our seven component sentiment index fell to even more extremely fearful territory, indicating the market could soon reach a nadir, but the CBOT, VIX, and VVIX indexes suggest that more volatility is likely headed this way in the coming weeks. Until volatility returns to the mean, caution still advisable. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Drs. Mark Faber and Burton Malkiel. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Dr. Burton Malkiel, professor and senior economist at Princeton University, penned A Random Walk Down Wall Street and the 11th edition. Welcome back, professor.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, you've been on the show now for nearly a decade. Last year, you noted that the CAPE ratio, price to earnings, were just a bit extended. And, well, we're starting to see signs of that. Would you mind sharing your outlook for 2016?
Sure. I think that the U.S. market is certainly still quite expensive. This CAPE ratio is the price-earnings ratio where you try to normalize earnings by looking at average earnings over a long period of time rather than just the last year's earnings. But whether you do it with this so-called CAPE ratio, cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, which is what CAPE stands for, or you just take the price earnings ratio based on the past 12 months, the U.S. market is not cheap. The question then for investors is, what do you do when everything is expensive? And I guess my advice would be that it just makes diversification even more important. While the CAPE ratio is something like 25 for the U.S., other parts of the world are less expensive and less extended than the U.S. market. And I would say that if you look at your portfolio and you've nothing outside the United States, so I'm not saying that the U.S. market is necessarily going to go down in 2016. I think the economy looks in pretty darn good shape. So, I'm not predicting any catastrophe in the market, but we are very richly valued. Other markets are more moderately valued, and the U.S. Is only something like a half or less of the world economy, and my advice to investors is to think globally, and if you're completely undiversified in terms of foreign stocks, think of adding them.
As you pointed out, things are a bit extended, but, you know, then there's also Europe and Asia where rates are being held much lower. Fed governors, policymakers look like they're going to raise rates in probably another 100 basis points at least in the next year or so. At least that's what they're calling for in the Fed minutes, and we're seeing signs of that at the Fed funds futures rates. And some of that could be felt in the long bond, the treasuries. Or do you feel that diversification will just take care of that for us?
Well, I do agree with you that we're in the United States likely to be in an era of rising rates. Unlike the people who say, this is terrible, that means we don't want to be in any paper assets, I think that the rise in rates is going to be quite moderate. And I say that because, as you pointed out, rates are much lower in other parts of the world than they are in the United States. And inflation is essentially non-existent. We're in a world which has a lot of excess manufacturing, particularly in emerging markets. China has an enormous amount of excess manufacturing capacity, and the same is true in many other emerging market countries. This, I think, is going to keep a lid on inflation, and I think is going to keep a lid on rates. Rates may rise, but I don't expect them to rise very much and very rapidly. We've already seen the Federal Reserve has done the first increase in the short-term rate. Lo and behold, the long-term rate is even lower than it was when the Federal Reserve nudged interest rates, short-term interest rates up. So, yes, I think there'll be a modest increase in interest rates, but I think it will be very modest and will not mean that we should simply get rid of all of our paper assets.
Nothing succeeds like success. 1.5 million plus copies sold of A Random Walk. You know, I try to tell folks who are outside of the field, I think it's difficult for biologists, chemists, people who work in fields where scientific tests are more, you might say, rigorous. The outcomes are more predictable. They can be easily replicated. Markets, however, and the economy, for the most part, are based on human emotions, greed and fear.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what you, that's precisely what you can't predict. And there are waves of over-optimism and sometimes waves of too much pessimism. And it's very, very difficult to predict what people are going to do. And so you will never, never have the kind of precision in predicting markets that the physicist will have in predicting what particles are going to do. And that's simply a fact. We've got to accept that there's going to be a great deal of unpredictability in terms of markets, and that's what the idea of a random walk is, simply that the next move is not predictable by me, by you, or by any expert. So be very cautious of the people who will tell you, well, I know for certain what the markets are going to do.
I think it's well said. And, you know, look at even Einstein, the founder of modern physics, couldn't wrap his mind around this idea of uncertainty at the quantum level, as you alluded to. Whereas Dirac and Schrodinger and so many others just said, look, we have to accept this. We have to embrace it. Led to this, you know, the great silicon and computer and information age, just embracing it instead of fighting it. So I think that's what investors really need to do with the random walk. They have to accept we can't outsmart the markets. And there are a few people who can, but they're going to have trouble over time, and the rare nugget like Warren Buffett, and he probably can't teach us what led to his success.
And now that he has a huge set of assets in Berkshire Hathaway, even recently, Berkshire Hathaway has not been outperforming the market. So, and interestingly enough, Buffett is the one who says now and actually put it in his will that he wants his heirs to just buy a simple index fund, which of course is what I've been arguing for a long time. You can now buy a fund that buys and holds all the stock in the market and charges as little as 1/20 of 1%. And that's, to me, still the very best investment advice. And period after period, that doesn't give you mediocre returns because you're paying way below average fees.
ETFs actually under fire right now by the SEC and other agencies that some of these fees and can be really exorbitant.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not telling you that every ETF is a good investment. I'm talking about the broadest ETFs that are the entire market. One that I favor trades under the ticker symbol VTI. And its expense ratio is 5 basis points, which is 1/20 of 1%. But not all ETFs, just the very broad ones with the lowest expenses.
You can outperform the top investors, the top money managers, the hedge fund managers. Paulson shorted housing market through Goldman, did a fantastic job, made over $1 billion. He's had a very challenging time, which really makes one wonder whether or not it was his models or whether or not he just happened to be.
With luck. And basically, the hedge funds over the last few years have been underperforming general market. They have not produced as high rates of return as the general market. Again, as Warren Buffett says, the wise investor will just buy very broad-based index funds. And my advice is to do so not only for the U.S. market, for international markets as well.
Well, as we pick up a copy of the latest 11th edition, A Random Walk, today on Amazon.com, as well as Barnes & Noble, local bookstores, give our listening audience an idea of some of the wisdom and what they should look forward to in the latest version.
Well, in the latest version, make very clear that very broad diversification is what is needed. And I will put down kinds of exchange traded funds that will fill the bill. As you pointed out, not all exchange traded funds are necessarily good investments. But what I try to point out is how using the same low cost index philosophy, you can get international stocks, you can get exposure to commercial real estate, you can get exposure to bonds, and I think you do some bonds in the portfolio. I also point out, and I think this is actually very important in this low interest rate environment, what an investor is going to be able to do to get income. We know that bank accounts give you no interest. We know that money funds give you no interest today. And so one of the investment suggestions in the 11th edition is you look very carefully at high dividend paying stocks as an income vehicle, and particularly the high dividend paying stocks that have shown an ability to grow their dividends over time. So one of the other things that I think is a particularly apt suggestion at the present time is to look carefully at those ETFs that will give you a healthy dividend yield, and a dividend yield that's likely to grow over time. Because I think this is particularly important, especially for retired people who are having a lot of trouble trying to find dividend and on which to live on. So there are specific suggestions on that kind of strategy, as well as what kinds of bond funds will at least provide some stable income over time.
Please have a wonderful new year.
Thank you very much, and all the best to you and your listeners.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KR
KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Welcome back to GoldSeek Radio.
Thank you very much.
Finally, after nearly a decade of holding rates at impossibly low levels, the Fed raised rates. Nevertheless, their counterparts in Europe and in other parts of the world are actually considering going further into negative territory. Do you see this as dollar supportive, and just what might it mean for the global currency world?
Well, I'm aware that just about anyone under the sun is so optimistic about the U.S. dollar. This is a view I do not necessarily share, because I do not expect the Fed to continue increasing rates. On the contrary, I think that sometimes in 2016, the Fed will again cut rates and more likely than not launch QE4.
QE4, I assume that would mean we'd be looking at further monetary easing plans, and we would see the purchase of mortgage-backed securities, credit default swaps, other derivatives, as well as treasuries to hold the market in place. There simply aren't enough buyers worldwide for the U.S. Treasury and for our toxic mortgage debt.
I think the economy is not very responsive any longer, and that applies to all countries in the world, to expansionary monetary policies, because they've been practiced for so long. So the impact is now diminishing. And there are many factors, aside from monetary policies and fiscal policies, that have an impact on the economy. And my sense is that the way the stock market has behaved, where the average stock is down more than 20%, but the indices are still holding up because of just a few stocks, that this is actually quite reflective of the U.S. economy, where a few companies and a few sectors are still doing okay, but the majority of sectors and the majority of people, the median household, the workers, the middle class, isn't doing well at all. So my view would be, it's more likely that the U.S. will go into recession within the next 3 months, if we are not yet in a recession, because industrial production is already down. Exports are down. Imports are down. These are quite powerful indicators. Of course, then the government publishes figures about employment, but these are vastly distorted figures, because, say, if you have one job, you are fired, and then you take two part-time jobs, then statistically one job has been lost, but two have been created. So a lot of statistics are very questionable in the U.S.
You know, underemployment is certainly a big problem, as well as record levels of poverty, or at least near poverty, with approximately 50 million Americans accepting food stamps to help keep dinner on the table. We also have other leading indicators, economic indicators, that are flashing at least yellow. Manufacturing rollover heavily in the United States, which tends to precede a recession.
Yes, the signs are all there that unlike all the strategists and economists who a year predicted a strengthening U.S. economy and a healing of the global economy, we have actually in most emerging markets already a recession or no growth or a very severe growth slowdown, with some sectors being in recession. All the economies in the world that depend on resources are basically in a recession. And in the U.S., and I wrote about this already 4 years ago, we have nowadays an economy and a social system that has a lot of resemblances to a banana republic.
We also have a bifurcated economy, I think you alluded to earlier. On the one hand, we see the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index plunging to lows not seen in years, another leading indicator. But then on the other, we see the retail sector holding up surprisingly well. Strength in retail, could that be correlated to perhaps higher debt levels, giving us the illusion of strength in that sector?
Well, I mean, we have to analyze how well retail is holding up. Because if I look at all the retail stores in the U.S., the performance of their stocks has been horrible. Horrible, not just bad, but horrible. And now someone can come and say, well, this is due that people buy now online, and so the traditional retailers are all suffering and so forth. I don't buy this argument entirely. What has been strong in retailing and in consumption has been, for instance, auto sales. And auto sales have been driven largely by credit. We have now a car loan industry that is over $1 trillion, car loans. And what has also been strong are home improvement items. In other words, the Home Depots have done well. But this has also a lot to do with the fact that people don't buy homes anymore, but they improve their existing homes. Or parents, they need some new furniture for their siblings who will stay at home, can't afford an apartment anymore. So this is also a debatable statistic whether that is so healthy.
We also have had difficulty in the energy sector. West Texas Intermediate crude plunging into low 30s, perhaps on its way to the 20s. That is good for the consumer, the largest component of our domestic economy. But then, of course, you also have the difficulties that stem from the large number of energy sectors in the S&P 500 weighing heavily on that sector and, of course, jobs as well. Any comments on the energy sector?
Well, I mean, this country with the largest industrial sector as a percent of GDP is South Korea. But the problem is that South Korea doesn't benefit much from falling commodity prices because their exports to commodity producers, including the Middle East, are larger than their exports to the EU and the US combined. So when the customers have less money, they also buy less from South Korea. And so net, the benefit actually is very, very minor or even negative. In the case of South Korea, December exports were down 13%. In the U.S., the consumer would be a prime beneficiary from low energy prices. Unfortunately, the U.S. has a president that found it necessary that for most people, insurance premiums are rising by 20, 30, 40% per annum at the present time. And, you know, for people who have a lot of money, say you make $1 million a year, it doesn't matter whether your health insurance premium goes up by 30%. But if you're a family of four and middle class, a working family, it makes a big difference. And if you have a car, yes, you benefit from lower oil prices, but if at the same time the tunnel fees, the toll roads, and the tolls at bridges all go up by double digits, it doesn't help you very much. So all these things have been offset to a large extent by extremely poor policies by the U.S. government.
The precious metals, a lot of aficionados in the audience here today. Higher rates ahead doesn't seem to bode too well for the metal, at least in the United States. But then with your forecast of perhaps Fed officials and policymakers having to backpedal, that might be the panacea that the precious metals bulls need.
Well, first of all, we had already a bear market in gold of more than 40% since September 2001. In other words, the bear market is more than 4 years old. Gold, compared to other assets, to stocks, bonds, and most currencies, in my view, is not particularly expensive. And the gold shares have started to outperform other stocks. And so I'm actually quite optimistic for gold to perform better than the S&P and better than other indices in 2016. In fact, I think that sentiment has been so negative recently about gold and gold shares that there is a significant upside potential. That would be my view. I'm not sure it's good news, but good news, basically, for someone who wants to buy gold would be for the gold price first to decline and provide a great buying opportunity, you understand? But I think already here it's at a very attractive level. So I bought some additional gold. Of course, I always buy gold, but on this weakness in the last month, I increased my position.
With the shocking increase in yields, it certainly doesn't seem to bode well for the debt and bond sector. Of course, stocks under pressure worldwide with Chinese policymakers and officials putting the brakes, their Shanghai index at least last week. You're obviously becoming a little more sanguine regarding the yellow metal. Do you see other interesting opportunities ahead in the commodities sector?
Yes. I mean, the same analysts who a year ago or 2 years ago were predicting oil to go to $150, now they say it will go to $20. I don't know whether it will go to $20 or not, but my sense is that between this level and 20, the market is very inexpensive. And my view would be that we could have a sharp rebound. Maybe not, maybe, most likely not to new highs, but say to an equilibrium price of between, say, $40 and $60, maybe $70. So, yes, I think in the commodities complex, there are now opportunities. I have to say that for individuals to play the commodity markets is not that simple. First of all, they need a futures account. And many people in the U.S., they don't want to have a futures account or they don't know how to open one. Then they buy ETFs, commodity ETFs. Commodity ETFs are just about the worst investment anyone can ever make because the rollover cost is far too high. So if a commodity, if you buy a commodity ETF and the commodity doesn't go up 30% in a year, you will probably lose money. Physical gold, the storage cost is relatively low. And you can buy physical gold, and you don't have to roll it over. So I would buy, if you really believe in a commodities rebound, my belief would be that precious metals would actually outperform other commodities.
And it also has the added benefits of avoiding rehypothecation and related issues that have come up all over the world. Not to mention potential confiscation issues, margin-related problems, and just a time where regulations and policies are coming into place that I think the typical investor may not be prepared for. The middle class used to be the backbone, if you will, of societies in the Western world, and it really was the aspiration of the working classes that their progeny might reach the goal of the middle class. That was really the dream that drove, I think, so much of the economic, and still does today to some extent. But we've just seen at least erosion of the middle class in the United States, maybe not so much in China and other BRIC nations. Can you give tips to the American middle class listeners today to help improve their economic situation?
Well, when I look back at the 50s and 60s and how rich Americans were relative to the rest of the world. I'm talking here relative. American workers, they earned a lot of money. They could go to Europe on holidays and live in Europe far above the life standard of Europeans, because the dollar at the time was very strong. It bought over 4 Deutschmark and 4 Swiss francs, whereas now it buys exactly about 1 Swiss franc. So a lot of things have changed in the world. We have, in the Western world, not just in the U.S., a generation of people that will die poorer and earn less in real terms, inflation adjusted, than their parents in the 50s and 60s, whereas in emerging economies, I can say that in China, we didn't have a middle class 30 years ago. And if I measure, say, a middle class, a simple indicator would be how many people can go on holidays and how many people can buy a car and so forth. So in China, for instance, in the mid-80s, there were less than 5 million Chinese traveling overseas. They were not allowed. And then by year 2000, there were 10 million Chinese traveling overseas. And now there are 120 million Chinese traveling overseas every year. With a shift in the balance of economic power, and it is, say, sad for me to see that the Western world has lost, relatively speaking, so much in such a brief period of time. And the only explanation I have for this loss in relative prosperity in such a short period of time are, and I can't use the word I would like to use, the government's idiotic policies and their interventions into free markets and with monetary policies that then lead to essentially an enrichment of few people, very few people, not 1%, 0.01%, and essentially an impoverishment of the majority of people. The media, they have been bought by the government, or their owners are bought by the government. They will always paint nice picture of what is happening in the economy, because they just watch the stock market and they watch Wall Street and New York that lives essentially from tourists, and the money printing that flows first into the financial sector. So, of course, there is a trickle-down effect in New York, but it hasn't really reached Main Street.
Perhaps you'd like to share with us a brief overview of your perspective on the year 2016, this new year.
Well, I think I mentioned before in interviews, I don't think the stock market will go up and that it will close lower and that we will drop between 20 and 40% from the May 2015 high, S&P 2134. However, I'm not the clairvoyant about what the Fed will do and other central banks. I think, as I mentioned in just now, that the Fed will embark on QE4, but to really have an impact and push markets to new highs, they will have to do a massive QE4. I would imagine in the order of $150 billion asset purchase every month. And whether politically that will be acceptable is debatable, because the elections are coming up.
Well, thanks again, Dr. Faber, for another excellent economic overview. We wish you an excellent 2016.
Thank you very much.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. This would have been an easy one to predict. The Senate just passed an $80 billion debt and spending bill, creating what has been called a debt holiday over the next 2 years by providing about $40 billion in new spending for 2016 and 2017. The Republicrats, which is what some call the distinction without a difference that Republicans and Democrats have become, voted for this in the middle of the night. Republicans who voted for the additional monies rationalized the process by saying it was worth busting the caps in order to get the Pentagon more money at a time when the U.S. is fighting the war on terror. Rand Paul referred to it as an unholy alliance between the left and right. Where has he been? That unholy alliance has been in place and has been the unspoken, unacknowledged agenda ever since I first voted back in 1980. The president is happy because this deal will break the cycle of shutdowns and manufactured crises, as he called it, that the executive branch and Congress have been through the last few years. Most inside the Beltway are happy because everyone's hot-button issues are getting funded. Education, job training, research, entitlement programs, and national security. Everybody's a winner, and it all got passed in the middle of the night with a bill that was crafted less than a week ago. The U.S. is fortunate for now by having the global reserve currency because it can pay its bills with the printing of money out of thin air. Having that money loaned into existence, paying interest on said money, which is the real objective, despite rhetoric and claims to the contrary, and thus avoiding hard austerity decisions the likes of which have been foisted upon country after country who cannot print their way out of financial crises. The most austerity those in Washington have to deal with when they need to plug an $80 billion shortfall is which takeout restaurant will they need to order in from during the several days it took to craft the 144-page deal that was written late on Monday and submitted for a Senate vote at 3 a.m. on Friday. From inception to vote, the deal passed in less than 100 hours, which represents over $1 billion an hour in new spending during the period of time the deal was active. Put another way, the 144-page document represents over $550 million per page. Nice work if you can get it. Going forward, I hope you will take with a grain of salt all the rhetoric and discussion about budget cuts and debates on spending, because in large part they are nothing more than psychological misdirection. Focus groups and polling tell politicians what they should be saying, because they think it's what the voters want to hear. And they do want to hear it, because they believe it's what they're supposed to think and want. But when push comes to shove, many really don't want what they advocate in terms of cuts, especially when those cuts impact them. So in true form, our political leaders have once again lied to the people in order to give them and themselves another opportunity to kick the can down the road. Because let's face it, that's where everyone prefers the can to be located. The giant pretending game known as Washington politics will continue until it can't. It's these 3 o'clock in the morning votes when our elected officials revert to their true genetic north. Hard consequences have been avoided, and now the sweet nothings and sweet little lies will once again begin to get told. That is, until it's time to cast the next budget deal and spending cap vote. Oh, there might be a lot more argument and debate the next time. But even if there is, it will get resolved by printing the difference, since that's the only tool Congress and the Fed have in their toolbox. The one-trick pony rides again. All will proclaim victory now, but in the end, we will all lose. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers or entertainment for their companies or professional organizations, especially during this holiday season, please visit my companion website at robertian.com, where I have a new video posted with condensed highlights from my stage hypnosis show. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris. Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Houston, we have a problem. Washington, we have a problem. Name your city because wherever you live, we have a problem. Even if, especially if, your city, your business, your profession, your lifestyle per se, has not yet officially been acknowledged as having problems. Those problems, those structural anomalies in the building blocks of your financial future are there. And even if you've done a tremendous job in planning and preparing for yourself and your family, the anticipated fallout from a massive financial reset will have ramifications that will shake you to the core of whatever level of preparedness you have attained. No matter where you are at, you must continue to critically analyze the rapid influx of new ideas and analyses thrust upon you each and every day. The New Year market sell-off has produced two distinct schools of thought that you will see represented in a combination of alternative and mainstream media analysts. Alternative analysts tend to be fiercely independent, often disagreeing with each other on many layers of an argument. They are much like overlapping circles. The circles overlap and have a commonality in the middle, with a variety of unique outlying perspectives that create niche opinions around a central theme. Mainstream media tends to consist of overlapping circles that have converged into a uniform or managed message that is broadcast to the masses for global consumption. Any unique outlying perspectives where the circles do not overlap, what I call acceptable parameters of debate, are managed and massaged for an official narrative. The current official narrative during this continual sell-off in the stock market is urging investors to stay the course and keep their money in the market for the long term. I don't see any headlines suggesting people convert any gains from this highly leveraged stock market into cash, never mind undervalued physical gold and silver. The mainstream pundits are leading with headlines that proclaim the bear market in stocks will be over before you know it. Others say much of the damage has already happened. If you believe that, do you have your own stop-loss number on the Dow? In other words, is there a certain level at which you will sell your portfolio, go into cash, and take a wait-and-see approach? It may be a question worth considering, especially when you look at how many of the alternative media analysts are interpreting the market at the moment. From an overlapping circle perspective, those circles are converging for the worst, with many calling for the market to drop by up to half or more to align itself with reality. It is an ugly financial reality that is being described. Very few saw the 2008 collapse coming. The injection of liquidity from the dot-com bubble burst, the fallout from 9/11, and the subsequent housing pump-and-dump ran its course during the early 2000s and culminated in 2008. That crisis never really ended. It's had a tourniquet applied to the wound. The patient is still alive, but the market is telling us their arm may need to be amputated. It's a real mess. And unlike 2008, lots of analysts are warning us with specifics on what to do. But I'm afraid there is still a tremendous amount of denial that exists and remains, even from those who vividly remember the trauma of 2008 and 2009. Now is not the time to tune out uncomfortable messages. If you have recovered somewhat or completely, or were fortunate enough not to have been impacted by 2008, now is not the time to wait until everyone is headed for the exits, because the off-ramps are small. And there are too many vehicles. A lesson that will once again be painfully well learned by many people who may never have another opportunity to recover if the markets reach the full negative potential that many expect yet this year. Anticipate the future and act on it in advance. Chris David Morgan has invited me to speak at his Las Vegas Solutions Conference on February 22nd, along with Chris Martinson, Greg Mannarino, and a team of experts. Details are at conquerchange.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at Conquer Change. Thanks, Chris.